Welcome. I'd like to acknowledge the continuing sovereignty of all First Nations peoples right across the country. Also, I'd like to acknowledge elders of the First Peoples of the land, and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country via the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, good morning, Amy. How are you?
Yes, I'm good this morning. How are you? How was the weekend?
Yes. Oh, it was great. Yep. If I felt any better, I'd be dangerous, Amy.
Good way to start a Monday.
It is. Now, our guest, Todd Fernando. Welcome to the program, Todd. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me, Tiger. How are you?
Oh, mate, on top of the world here.
That's good.
Tell us your mob, your country.
I grew up in Condobolin on Wadjuri country, and so it's a pretty exciting country. It's a big country, big, beautiful country, and I love heading back there every chance I get.
So you're Wadjuri, Todd?
Yeah, on both sides. I'm very lucky to stay within that mob, and spread right across from Condo to Walgett to Gilgandra.
Yeah, a lot of mob up that way. I really like Condo. Nice, peaceful little town.
It is a little peaceful little town, but it's a gossip town nonetheless as well.
I know that too.
Everyone knows everyone.
Yeah, I think that's the same everywhere, eh?
Yeah, that's it.
So tell us a little bit about growing up, because today, for our listeners' knowledge, we're talking about same-sex marriage, but also about how it's going to affect or not affect in any way our communities, Aboriginal communities. Tell us a bit about growing up in Condobolin as a young sort of gay man coming of age.
It was really interesting, and I often look back and think about my journey and my experience there. It being a small country town, you know, I repressed a lot of my sexuality growing up just because I didn't really have the opportunity to see other gay people growing up. And so that to me sort of indicated that, you know, it wasn't the norm and it wasn't okay at the time. And so I hid a lot of who I was and a lot of that side of my identity.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until we sort of moved out of Condobolin to Sydney, where I finished high school, that I came into my element and who I was. And you know, my family accepted me with open arms, which was great. But there was still, you know, I look back and I think, you know, a lot of those times where, you know, young black fellas or young people in general are growing up and without the awareness or without seeing, you know, other people like them, it can be hard to sort of feel like they fit in a world where, you know, their sexuality is not acknowledged in some parts of their communities.
And even directly frowned upon. I know in Condo there's, I don't know if it was there when you were growing up, but there's a shop that's owned by, I think, a gay man, and they actually call it the FAG shop, but obviously saying the word. So even growing up in an environment, and it would be the same all around the country to many young black fellas growing up, that's openly hostile. I mean, how scary. When you went to Sydney, you found it a lot more opening to come out.
Well, it was a lot more opening to come out because I saw a lot more gay people. And so living in that rural country town, not seeing the opportunity really sort of pushed me not to want to break the mold, for lack of a better phrase. But it just allowed me to sort of understand that, you know, some parts of me can remain hidden without other people really needing to realise. And it wasn't until, I did move to Sydney that I came into my own. But when I did come into my own, I realised, you know, who I am is nobody else's business, really. But it really allowed me to shine through. And you know, I often go back to country, and you know, they're fully accepting, and you know, a lot of conversations were had and they still are happening, which is good. But you know, I think there's a long process still in the works.
How do you think it affects Aboriginal kids generally? Because you're not just dealing with the problems affecting gay youth, but also black youth. I mean, there's that intersection, that double oppression, isn't there? Coming to terms with your Aboriginality as well.
It's really interesting, and I'm finding sort of within my research now that, you know, it can be quite traumatic to live this this double life, if you will. And we know with the high rates of suicide within our communities, it's just another factor, it's another pressure that we have on ourselves that, you know, we're getting discrimination from, you know, the wider community in terms of being Indigenous, but also, you know, getting discrimination from within our community for being gay. So it's sort of this double-edged sword of oppression, really.
There's a fairly high rate of lack of understanding and open criticism within our own mob, isn't there?
Yeah, there is, and it's quite surprising, considering, you know, blackfellas should be the first to understand what it's like to feel discrimination and prejudicism, but, you know, sometimes we are the first to offer our own thoughts on other topics where sometimes we should just butt out, I guess. I mean, it's good to have an open debate, but it's also good to have an understanding of, oh, you know, I wonder if that person is feeling how I felt, and that lady wouldn't sit next to me on the bus or grabbed her purse a little tighter when I walked down the street.
When you look at the history of, obviously, the oppression faced by both the gay LGBTI community and blackfellas, I mean, there's a lot of similarities in that history of oppression, isn't there?
There is. You look at sort of the stuff around the Sydney Mardi Gras when that was first coming out, that faced a lot of criticism and a lot of setbacks, but, you know, they prevailed, much like, you know, blackfellas did growing, you know, through the 50s and 60s and 70s, fighting for, you know, a multitude of rights. And it's, you know, along side by side, and while our histories are very different from gay fellas and blackfellas, the feelings of wanting to be accepted and wanting equal status and wanting to be accepted is very much the same.
That's very true. How do you think there's still a lot of homophobia within Aboriginal communities from your perspective?
I do. And I think that stems down to this sort of... well, I always think back and think, you know, Aboriginal people, yeah, they were colonised by non-Indigenous people, white people, but they were also colonised within religious beliefs. And so setting up all of these missions and getting ingrained in this religious outlook on life really drove and pushed this... that sexuality was different. You know, sexuality was, if you wasn't attracted to the opposite sex, then it was wasn't right, wasn't normal. And I think the attitudes from religious beliefs really come into play when we look at sort of the homophobia within Aboriginal communities, because, you know, religion is a large, big part of sort of a lot of Aboriginal people's lives, because of you know, stemming from colonization, stemming from sort of this wave of European settlement and missions and stuff being set up. So it does affect us quite a lot, but it's interesting that we often forget that, you know, sexuality as we know it nowadays didn't really exist the same way that it did prior to 1788.
It's interesting you mentioned religion, because just over the weekend, or last week, there's actually a petition called the Uluru Bark Petition presented to Parliament, and I think... Senator Erica Betts was promoting it, and it was produced by a Peter Walker, who's an Aboriginal preacher, and I understand Tiger has known him for quite a long time.
I've known Peter for 30-odd years. He was in Redfern when I was down there, Western Sydney.
Based out at Mount Druitt, which
That's
is
right.
where my family is. And, you know, I finished high school in Mount Druitt, and I was recently there over the weekend just visiting back, and... you know, it's quite interesting. I go back and I think, you know, I've met Peter a couple of times, and I just find it really, really shocking that people will go to sort of this length to do something so horrendous and so devastating for me as a young black man trying to look up on looking at role models within our community, and you know, we see these so-called elders pushing something that. An agenda that it's going to damage a lot of our communities, because, you know, the high number of blackfellas who are gay or questioning even, you know, are going to want to repress more and you know, stay away from their communities out of a fear that they're going to be ridiculed or they're going to, you know, the violence is going to continue, I guess, for them.
And just for our listeners, that petition was basically said on behalf of Aboriginal Australia, and it's basically condemning, well, sort of promoting traditional marriage and condemning this push for same-sex marriage, which is currently a politically hot topic. And they've signed up a number of Aboriginal nations, and I really encourage all the blackfellas out there to go and see if your nation is on the list and see
nations
if you actually support that. Yeah,
I would say individuals, and I would say that this is a very much a, I think, a very small numbers of a minority thing amongst our own mob, Todd, I would think.
Wiradjuri is listed on one of those.
Is Wiradjuri there?
Yeah, your own people. There you go.
There's heaps of nice Wiradjuri young gay blackfellas around, I'm sure, wouldn't support that petition.
Well, even straight gay, straight Wiradjuri mob, they wouldn't support it at all. So I think this is a minority view. It's a very distorted view. It's a very assimilated view. And how dare they use Uluru? I mean, there's a cultural appropriation taking place there as well.
Well, Mutajulu
and there's no reference
to Mutajulu.
There's no reference to Mutajulu there, and that's their country, you know. But I just think it's cultural appropriation for someone like this to be using and appropriating Uluru and saying Uluru bark paint, bark petition.
I agree. And Todd, what does it mean by traditional marriage? How do you view traditional marriage? As an Aboriginal person.
Yeah, look, as an Aboriginal person, you know, it's just, I view it and the stories that I've heard are so different from what, you know, you sign the piece of paper in the church and you do, you know, the Gammon ways of getting married.
Gammon ways.
That's why there's not a lot of black fellas into marriage, mate. I've got 9 daughters and not one of them have gotten married.
You know, it's just, and I look back and I just think, oh my God, what are they trying to say? And to say that, you know, intersex marriage didn't exist within our communities prior to then is absolutely ridiculous. There's stories from all parts of the country that talk about, you know, black fellas, you know, marrying in you know, intersexually, and you know, we look at, you know, the folks in Tiwi Islands, for example, who have a large population of queer people and transgendered people that just is a community that is accepting, and you know, they have their hard times, but they're generally accepting. And we look at, you know, their traditional approaches, and we think, you know, it's so far different from what you know, this concept of a traditional marriage between a man and a woman is, because it's a fallacy created through religion, really.
Also, there's our traditional, from what I understand, First Nations traditions, more than one wife. Is it polygamy?
Yeah.
Is it polygamy?
How many wives
you
got?
Tiger, you want another wife.
Right? How many wives you got?
That's greedy now.
It's something that silly, young, testosterone-loaded black males often claim, and I did claim, look, I'm a traditional, I'm allowed to try to tell my missus this, you know, at the time. Yeah. I almost got knocked out, hunted out of the house, and rightly so. But on a more serious note, I've also been told that that's in the Bible, it's accepted in the Bible. I mean, I don't know, I never read the Bible, that passage that said more than one wife was okay. But there's that difference with traditional marriages. You referred to Tiwi Islands. What do you put it down to, that there's a higher rate of, you said transgenders and queers? What do you put that down to?
In conversation with a lot of those mob from Tiwi Islands, for my research and for other things, for other works that I've done with them, for me, I look and I think and I feel and I hear their stories that they're a community that has been affected by colonization, but they've been able to regain and keep a lot of their sort of traditional culture and their traditional way of thinking and their traditional psyche. And I think that has a lot to do with this acceptance of being who you are and this acceptance of difference, that, you know, you don't have to be a man or a woman, you don't have to be either or, but you don't have to be straight or you don't have to be gay. And there's this idea or this notion, I guess, that you can be who you are, and I think that community is doing it really, really well.
All right.
Looking at that and looking at the different views and the fact blackfellas didn't operate in the traditional Christian sense when it came to marriage. When you look at this same-sex marriage debate, do you think it has many applications for our communities? Do you think a lot of young black or, you know, gay blackfellas actually care or want to be involved in this debate? Do you think it's just something that we should boycott or bypass?
It wasn't until recently that I was thinking heavily about this, and this was around the time when Facebook created their new Pride campaign where you change your profile picture to the rainbow flag, and that was going around a lot. And through my Facebook, you know, I think 75-80% of my friends on Facebook are black fellas, and not, you know, a lot of them are straight familied black fellas, but they were all changing their profile pictures in support of the, you know, the laws changing in the States, which is what this stemmed from. And it was really interesting because it was in that moment that I saw the conversation, while it hadn't occurred, was opened to be now occurring, because a lot of these straight black fellas were showing their support. And, you know, it filled me with joy to see, you know, to see so many mob changing their profile pictures as a public stance to, you know, I support gay people in their rights. And, you know, not even a month later, you know, the Uluru Bark petition is presented to the government.
So sort of built the self-esteem or built the pride. It's more about that, is it, seeing that level of solidarity?
That's what it is. It's that level of solidarity. It's that level of, you know, black fellas understanding what it's like to be hurt through discrimination and rejecting it and saying, no, if other mob want to do what they need to do, then who are we to judge? Who are we to say no? Because, you know, we fight and we kick and we protest and we complain when we don't get things that we should have. We don't get the rights that we should have. But there's no way that we as Aboriginal people should say to other mob that, no, sorry, you don't deserve that right. You don't deserve that equal
Good
status.
Point.
I think it's really important to frame it as a rights issue. It's very much an equal rights issue. It's not about marriage or preserving the sanctity of traditional marriage. It's about equal rights. Have everyone, regardless of your sexuality, having the same rights as others, isn't it? And it's something that hasn't been framed that way.
No, that's right. And, you know, how many straight mob get divorced all the time? You know, plenty of mob get divorced, and they want to worry about the sanctity of marriage.
Oh yeah, no, it's
and this idea that, you know, it's funny, and I always think back and I look at different parts of the Bible that talk about different things, and it's funny how, you know, these mob have just chosen a particular passage in the Bible to run rampant with. I mean, the Bible says that if a child talks back to their parents, they could be stoned to death. If, you know, you're not allowed to eat shellfish, but, you know, we choose to ignore those things, but choose to actively seek out and push an agenda on other things. So that needs to be hypocritical.
I just think how, when I look at the Uluru Bark petition, I mean, let's have a look at it. You look at Uluru, and I've already stated, that's an appropriation of culture there.
Mm-hmm.
The Bark petition, I mean, there's a sensationalist trying to be authentically black, I suppose.
It's like the You're a Colour Bark petition, or, you know, the Barunga statement, which was about land rights, you know?
Yeah,
so I look at that sort of stuff and think, wow, here's a bunch of assimilated Christians that are just hardcore Christians and don't worry about rights. That appears to be that they're cool just being Christians and... there's no room for that sort of stuff in my life, you know.
But you just wonder how the situation which they signed it under, whether the people were told exactly what it was, I guess.
Welcome back to Let's Talk. I've got a caller on the line, Selwyn from Cairns. How are you, Selwyn?
Well, thank you, brother. Good morning to Amy and to the guest there too. Good morning there.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Three quick comments. You know, the saying, I'd like to see that. I'd like to see Stephen Oliver do a send-up of Guess Who's Coming to Dinner.
Yeah, right. That should be black comedy,
he'll be
too.
He'll be onto it. Don't worry. He doesn't let much slip by in that bloke.
Yeah. And the second one was there's a bishop on TV, in the early times. He traditionally married 120 misses to save him.
Hey.
To save him from, I don't know what he was supposed to say. He was a bishop in the Tiwi Islands. And the last one was young scholars were also promised to our women too as well.
Oh, really? Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
All right.
There's yeah, okay, thank you.
Hey, thank you, Selwyn, for your contribution. You have a good day up there in Cairns. Interesting comment there.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
I would like to see Stephen Oliver do something too.
Mm, yes.
Imagine how funny. And even if we look back at black comedy and the impact that Stephen's skit had on, you know, the entire population of Aboriginal people, everyone was walking around saying the catchphrases and doing those deadly dance moves and, you know.
Including my 4-year-old grandson, I mean, yeah. Coming out with, well, what's this? And yeah.
Not let us say it online.
4-year-old, just come out of the blue. Oh, that Quaiden, I tell you, he's amazing. Yeah.
We were talking about the Uluru Bark Petition before, and I'm wondering how looking at that Bark Petition, and I know it didn't get a lot of coverage, and that's fortunate, but I guess even just looking at the wider debate around same-sex marriage and confronting homophobia in your own community, I mean, when young gay black fellas growing up see something like the Uluru Bark Petition, what do you think is the effect on kids?
It's going to be quite traumatic. A lot of these feelings that a lot of young black fellas are going to be having around sexuality is going to be repressed. It's going to cause a lot of sort of mental instability because they can't truly be who they want to be. So it's going to have a vast effect on a lot of young black fellas who are questioning their identities and questioning what it is that they want in life. And to see this and to see, you know, even the words, you know, that, you know, the sanctity of marriage between a man and a woman continues to be held in honour among all Aboriginal people, you know, that means, and, you know, if I'm a young black fella, I'm looking at that and think, yep, that's what my mum or that's what my auntie or that's what my grandmother or my grandfather or my uncles are going to be thinking. So I can't truly be who I am. And so we often see a lot of and hear a lot of young gay black fellas will leave their communities to go into the bigger cities to be able to be who they are. And, you know, for a long time, I was very, you know, very fortunate to grow up on country, but equally fortunate to grow up in Sydney, because it allowed me to sort of, you know, go head out and experience other communities and experience the gay community. And, you know, a lot of that was done in secret out of fear that my family would reject who I was, who I am.
How might things be different if you never made the break from Condo, a young gay black in Condoblin growing up? How might things be different for you?
For me, I think I often look back. I was there recently about 2 months ago, and I was talking to a cousin of mine who's still in the closet, still not out and open with the entire family. And you know, he trusted me from a very young age, and we've always had conversations around it. And, you know, he feels very unsupported and very, very limited. He feels empowered when he sees, you know, other gay people within our family come back to Condoblin for different things. And for a fleeting moment, he can feel safe. But he knows that's not going to last long for when the family then leaves. And, you know, he's left there being one of the only few that are feeling this way, even though there's a lot more. But it's going to be very traumatic. And I think my life would be a lot different. I certainly wouldn't be doing the things that I'm doing now, and I certainly don't think I'd be out and open and honest with myself and with my family about who I am. But that could be different. It could have been different.
Who knows?
So I guess there's a challenge for setting up a lot of those support structures in regional and remote communities, because it's so traumatic to leave your community, especially young black fellas. A lot of people wouldn't want to, you know, and why should they have to leave their community? Mm-hmm. Do you know how we start setting up those support structures, or if we're just so far away from that, given that the whole national debate is centred around same-sex marriage? It's nothing. It's pretty much that's our gay rights issue. There's nothing else on the agenda.
No. And I think we start by, I mean, if we look at the past when black and white people couldn't marry together, you know, there was a time where a lot of this happened. A lot of those rights were alleviated. But we look at it now, and I think the conversation just needs to be had within communities and within families. And families could start by saying, you know, they could be reading this Uluru Bark petition and talking with their family and saying how ridiculous it is, or even their own views on what they feel it is, because that way, while they're not directly having a conversation about sexuality or having a conversation directly about, you know, if there could be any gay people in the family, it's just basically saying, you know, if there happened to be, then I would support. It's hinting at it. And I think if those types of conversations happen, a lot of young people and a lot of the Aboriginal people who are in the closet, or even who are out of the closet, who are too scared to even bring up this conversation with their families, could start to have those conversations and start to weave a new journey or a new narrative around it's okay to have a different sexuality.
Todd, I know some members of my own family and extended family, and friends, people in the community, where we have a member of our family that is obviously gay, but the family around them want to deny it.
I was just going to say the same thing, Tiger.
Everybody else around, you're like, oh, yeah, well, that's cool. You know, that's cool. Whatever floats their boat, then don't.
It's just like, don't
mine.
Put it in our face. I think that's the perception. We know you're gay, but just don't put it in our face.
But if you say, you ever thought about so-and-so? You think you might be gay? Oh, no, not at all. Yep. How could you say that?
So there's a fear to even amongst our own mob and families to start that conversation, isn't there?
Yes, there is. Then, Todd, I want to also say, Peter Walker, the preacher. How dare these Christians put themselves up on pedestals when we have so much abuse of boys by those bloody churches and teachers and preachers and people? How dare they? How dare he?
How dare he, all right. And so people forget where they come from. People forget what it feels like to be discriminated against. And I sit back and I look at Peter and I look at the others and I just think, it's just not okay. It's just not okay. It damages relationship. It's going to damage young black fellas. And to stand up and call yourself elders while you are, you know, you are ignoring a large part of your community, it's not okay.
Is there any percentages of how many Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander, how big the community actually is?
Not specific, not set in stone. There's no solid data that's been collected so far. But if from sort of speaking, you know, frankly, there's seriously a lot of young gay black fellas. I see it everywhere, and I know a lot of young black gay black fellas myself. So while there isn't set statistics, there is a hope that the number will get into the open consciousness. I guess the research needs to be done on it a lot more.
Because when you talk about these issues of homophobia in society affecting Aboriginal LGBTI youth, in what ways do you mean by damaging? I know that you've done a bit of work in suicide and youth suicide. Mm. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Because our communities have high rates of youth suicide, and so do the gay community.
So when I talk about that, I often think back to a couple of statistics, and I think back to you know, the statistic that if you were born queer in Australia, you were 33% more likely to commit suicide.
That's horrible.
If you were born Indigenous, I think the number it was 9 or 10 times more likely to commit suicide. So if we combine those two stats together for a young Indigenous gay man, it's quite horrific. And when I talk about damaging, I'm talking about, you know, that if you're not feeling comfortable within your community and suicide is an option, they're going to take it. They're going to feel so low because, you know, mental health in communities is already starting to. It's slowly. There's a lot of work being done, but you know, it still is a taboo topic in some cases. And so when there's a feeling of no support, when there's a feeling of I've got really nobody to talk to, unfortunately, you know, a lot of these young mob are going to commit suicide. And what that happens then is it starts the clustering effect again. And, you know, the more people that are committing suicide, the more normal it becomes. And we definitely do not want to go down that path. So
confronting this and having these conversations, in a way it's almost a life or death issue because we don't know how prevalent this actually is, do we?
No, we don't. We don't. And you're right, it is a life or death issue. I look back and I see, you know, especially back in Condoblin, in other small country towns around Rajri country and around the actual country, I see a lot of young gay black fellas committing suicide, and it's really, really sad. And I look back, and a couple that I have known, you know, did commit suicide because of their feelings towards support or the lack thereof. And it's quite sad when we think that, you know, a lot of I had a friend who thrived in the city and was open and was out and was happy and got called back to his community for some commitments and went back and within a couple of weeks had committed suicide because he had to repress his happy self from being in the city. And it's quite sad to think that, you know, just the journey back to country can often damage someone so much to the point where they feel like they need to end their lives. And, you know, we as Aboriginal people should be able to support all of our mob to be and do who they want, because we are the first to stand up and say, no, you can't treat me like that, if we're being treated wrongly against the colour of our skin or against who we are as Aboriginal people. And I just think it's time that we all stand up to these types of issues and these call to rights, because we know exactly how it feels, and it's not our place to be able to discriminate against other people.
Well, it's not our place to be doing what the dominant culture is doing to us, you know, the oppression and the discrimination and all of that sort of stuff, the marginalisation. We're just following in the footsteps, and it is not right. Where do we start with this, with making some changes in it within our own mob, in our community?
It does. It stems with conversations like these. It stems with conversations where it can occur. It can start small or it can start big. And I guess if we slowly start to show our support within our communities, and something will definitely ignite, and the spark and the flame will grow immensely, and we'll see a lot of young black fellas become more happier, become more free, and a lot of let's be honest, a lot of older black fellas who've repressed for many, many years, be able to be set free and be able to say, you know, I see my communities and I see my families supporting these issues, therefore they're going to support me in my journey. And I think that would be a brilliant step forward. We can see, you know, a lot of AMSs could start, you know, changing and uploading some posters to their walls around supporting these issues and you know, just get the visibility out there. Because when I was growing up in Condoblin, I didn't see any queer pamphlets, any gay pamphlets. And, you know, seeing one of those would have changed a lot for me. It would have allowed me to think a little bit more on the issue. And I think we start by having the conversations.
It's not just the gay community that we've got hang-ups about. We as a black community, look at our mob, how racist and discriminatory they can be towards Asians at 10, 15, 20 years ago, Africans, Muslims, people now. A lot of our mob are openly offensive and critical of other groups. So we got a bit of a problem with this being too wanting to be too white.
It's almost become normalised. I know, for example, derogatory terms like, I hate the word FAG, but I hear it all the time, you know. What sort of impact do those sort of things have on young gay youth?
Terminologies are huge, and they stem down and create a sort of the deeper, darker sort of conversations that we have with ourselves in our head. And when we hear those words, depending on what situation we're in, whether we're out and open, we can look at those terms and we can, you know, roll our eyes or throw back some shade or some sass. Or if we are, you know, in the closet, we often repress more. We often recluse a lot of our identity in that part. But it's interesting, there was a book about growing up queer that I read recently, and the author, I'm just trying to think of his name, but it will come to me, was one of the lines he spoke about was about this homophobia and about these derogatory comments. And that, you know, a lot of these people who were throwing these comments were often themselves repressing parts of their sexuality. Mm. And I love, you know, talking about that because, you know, it runs scared. People then stop using the term.
So that's a great way to combat, is it?
I worked with a couple of students, a couple of groups of students, and during one of the sessions, one of the boys, you know, yelled at the FAG and everyone sort of went quiet, and you know, I didn't say anything. I was standing up the room facilitating a session and just sort of turned to him and told him about that story. And, you know, it got a bit of a humor, got a bit of a laugh, and it got a bit of a giggle. And from that, he stopped using that word. It was just the simple conversation. It was just that simple, hey, mate, you know, what if I called you, you know, an offensive term for, you know,
I
don't want to say anything, but, you know. It's just, yeah.
I'm just wondering, and I don't know if it's a similar case, but in regards to gay rights campaigns, with feminism, I'm often very frustrated at the debate and that it's very white-centric and it's always geared towards a certain demographic of women. Do you think the campaigns around gay rights leave out Aboriginal and Torres Strait issues?
Yeah, without a doubt they do. Gay rights is a white gay rights in my view, and I see it and I look like that because a lot of those campaigning are white, and so it's just interesting when we look back and we think about the history of it. You know, it's a very, very white community set focused, but that's not to say that there aren't any people of colour or black people themselves within that fight and within those communities that are doing standing up for a lot of it. But yeah, it's really interesting you mentioned the feminism. It's quite interesting because, you know, there's this idea of white feminism and sometimes that does impact and it looks better. And then we get people within our communities like Celeste Little, for example, who are just groundbreaking.
She's deadly.
She's fantastic.
Filters nothing, but in the best way.
She's another regular on this program. She's fantastic. Now, let's look across at, just a comment here on the sanctity of marriage. That's a white thing. Mm. Let's have a look at the environmental movement. There's a white thing that ignore black rights. Mm-hmm. They ignore the history and the expertise and the ancient knowledge of First Nations people.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's all on white terms of reference, you know. It's white thing. The constitutional recognition, it's a white thing.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to muddy the waters here, but...
No. One of the things that you are bringing up is, and it's this idea that a lot of these things that people think they're fighting for is a white issue. I mean, but we look at back and I remember, I think I saw a comment, it was probably on one of Celeste's posts, George Christensen posting tweeting a photo with some elders, Aboriginal elders, with a copy of the Uluru Bark petition, who himself, you know, reject the redefinition of marriage on a cultural basis. And one of the comments I remember reading in the community was whether he was also going to reject the colonial property ownership out of respect for traditional views on land ownership.
Well, that would be great. That'd be a turning point, wouldn't it?
And so it's interesting what they themselves choose to say that blackfellas have the right to say on it and that we should listen to them on this issue. But, you know...
All on their terms.
All on their terms.
All on their terms
and what they want.
Yeah, very true. And what would, when you talk about gay rights campaigns being very white, I mean, how do we get, or how do young gay blackfellas get a voice in that? I mean, is there any movements or specific groups that are sort of popping up?
Yeah, so I chair Anthem, which is an Aboriginal Nations and Torres Strait Islander HIV youth movement, and we are a collective of young people who sit on a national committee that's working in changing the conversation, look and feel of HIV and sexual health in Aboriginal communities, specifically within in young Indigenous communities, because the high rates of STIs and the high rates of HIV within our communities is quite embarrassing. It really is.
What are the rates? Do you know off the top of your head, or?
Not specifically off the top of my head, but it's quite a lot. There was in one community, one of the reports spoke about that. In one community, if you had unprotected sex, you'll be 15 times more likely to contract an STI. Just, you know, horrendous. But yeah, so Anthem is doing a lot of work both online about changing the way we view sexual health not to be taboo anymore, having these open conversations, visiting the doctors and building the awareness that, you know, sexual health is part of any health lifestyle and that we should embrace it just as much as we do with cardiovascular disease or diabetes or kidney failures and stuff like that. So
Do we have a situation, when you talk about the taboos, do we have a situation particularly in the gay community where a lot of people wouldn't even realise they've contracted some of these STIs or HIV?
Well, yeah. A lot of these sexual health, well, a lot of these STIs, they don't have any symptoms, or some do, some don't. And so, you know, they could be living their lives with an STI and, you know, without preventative methods, without going to the doctor and actually talking about them. They could be, you know, passing it from one person to the other, and that mixes between both gay and straight relationships. And you know, when we, especially in, you know, when I go back to Condobolin, and even when I was there as a teenager, there was no way I was talking to my doctor about being gay, let alone having gay sex, because you know, it was at an AMS and you know,
everyone knows everyone.
And so the conversation just isn't had, unfortunately. I think a lot of that stuff has moved and changed now, especially in today's society. But a lot of work is being done in ensuring that, you know, sexual health is being spoken about within certain, you know, doctor offices and even within community health programs. And, you know, AMS Western Sydney, Blessed Soul, had, you know, a lot of good work within sexual health out at Mount Druitt, and
that's going to be gone soon, isn't it? They've defunded the AMS out there.
They have defunded the AMS, and I think their last day for most of their staff was yesterday.
Oh God! They
did an amazing job within sexual health out at Mount Druitt.
What a damn shame they throw the baby up with the bathwater. You know, if there's issues about governance, sort it out. You don't shut down a whole damn service.
No, that's right.
Affect a whole community. But Todd, right. It appears to me that again there's a need for black men to step up and take some responsibility across the board. While we don't, and I think black men should lead this thing, and at least should take the initiative. But no, we've got to wait for our women that have done it for probably 100 years or longer, but to my own personal experience, they've done it for 40, 45 years or so, where they've taken the initiative with whatever it is in the community. But we're not doing justice to our young while we as black men still have some sort of a hesitancy to practice safe sex. It's no, just get out there and get it on sort of thing, you know, get down, don't get it on, get down to it and without getting it on. And I'm talking about the condoms and stuff like that.
Yes,
but
yes,
we're not doing justice to our young, particularly our young males.
No.
While we sit back and sit in the passenger seat, we as black men must step up and take responsibility for a whole range of things here, right across the board.
We do, and I think it's a good call to action to have, because, you know, our roles in society have drastically changed from a patriarchal to a matriarchal, especially in Aboriginal communities, and I think, you know, it's time for us to stand up equally. It's time for us as Aboriginal men to say, you know, I also support, I also do this. A lot of those fathers who you know, unfortunately are out of touch with their children could easily come back into people's lives by supporting, by standing up and saying, you know, it's about time that we fight this journey together. We fight this journey as a community or as a family, because until we do that, a lot of issues that a lot of black fellas have isn't going to be challenged or isn't going to be changed. And until we all start supporting each other's rights and each other's causes and each other's journeys.
Todd, just before we go, I wanted to ask you a bit about your research, because you're actually undertaking, and you're a young black fella, you're undertaking a PhD at University of Melbourne in Indigenous sexualities. Can you tell us a little bit about that before we go?
Yeah. So I was recently, this was a couple of years ago, in I was invited to, there was a Growing Up Queer report that was done in 2013 that I was fortunate enough to be one of the faces of, and put it out there as much in the media as possible. And it got me thinking, because after reading the report and seeing some of the statistics about growing up queer in Australia, got me thinking about what it's like to grow up Indigenous and queer in Australia. And so it's always been in the back of my mind, and it's something that I've lived with for 26 years now. And so I got the opportunity to figure out what I wanted to do my PhD on, and decided that that's exactly what I wanted to do it on. So I've been at Uni Melb now for a year and a half, thinking and writing and researching in the spaces of what it is actually like to grow up queer and Indigenous in Australia. And some of the stuff I am finding it very exciting, and I can't wait to publish and to present it all, because, you know, as much as there are bad, horrible issues that we face, a lot of the time we just have the best time. We are deadly mob, and we know how to get down and get down. But, you know, it comes past and parcel with the harsh realities, but some of the deadliest moments. And
that's a very colourful mob. Very colourful.
Yeah. I've always wanted to go to Mardi Gras and see the blackfella float.
It is absolutely, and it was one of the better experiences that I had within the Mardi Gras community. Is, you know, when it was the 2013 Mardi Gras, I led it with Matthew Field.
I know, yeah. Maddie. He's deadly. He's from Olgut.
Yeah, he's Olgut mob. So me and him held the First Nations banner and led the entire parade down Oxford Street.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, it was an amazing experience to have so many people shouting and yelling support, and to be there with, you know, hundreds of other black mob who were just, you know, loud and sassy and crazy.
It was
great to be within that community.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's good to be. It's good to see that happen all the time, and good to see our mob taking such a prominent role in that particular event. Mate, we have to go. It's been great talking to you, and I'm looking forward to another chat with you down the track. I'm sure Amy will arrange that for us.
It'll be awesome.
Yeah?
Sounds good.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Really good. Thank you. You have a great day, and keep up the great work, man.
You too.
Good on you. Bye now. It is time for River Story, written and voiced by Ross Watson.
And so it continues. The power of the written word appears to carry more weight in the minds of modern people than the reality of creation itself. Even today, with the ice caps melting, the ruled masses cannot disempower their leaders and are still alienated from land and essential species. The shamans are now known as priest, media, politician, academic and salesman, and all rely on the power of the written word. Where is the truth of my children who kept my waters clean and maintained proper balance between my species? My children are called primitive, and their birthright is stolen. My humans lived as full people and respected the things that allow all species to exist. For countless generations, they bequeathed their children creation's natural and essential birthright of clean air and water. I carry the stories of their history in the various parts of my basin. These stories are experienced by some bush travellers during the quieter times of my flow. Sometimes family groups can be glimpsed in the light of a waning moon when the night is still and the scent of tea tree mingles with the smells and scratchings of the turkey scrub. Songs and laughter are heard, but shadowy paths receive no footprints when the shadowy figures pass. The voices tell the camping Murray the story of that place, there by the hidden waterhole, or around a deserted sitting down place, the message echoes through my ravaged country. Yo Murray, this is a good place. This is Kungaloo ground. Tell our people we are here. Tell them you heard our songs, their songs. When they are done with grieving, we are here. When they are ready to become full people again, we are waiting. The songs are in the soil, trees, rocks and water. The happy songs are eager to welcome children back to country. The totem songs are waiting to sing up protection, and the law songs can be found when our people are full human once more. Tell them we are here, waiting. The river is their lifeblood. They must not forget forever. When they return, this place will know them by their breath. And they need to bring the Miglu and teach them about country. The pale skins have waited long to be free and full people. And so it is. When certain children of my old people visit their tribal grounds, they are welcomed. Although our present condition is not healthy, my country and me rejoice each time one of our scattered children returns to us, even when they do not stay. Our greeting may be a scratch to capture their blood and freshen our memory of them and to ensure they know country recognise them. At other times, numbers of a totem or naming species of bird or animal may gather and remain nearby during visits by those of proper spirit. In these and other ways, we acknowledge each other and confirm our connections because my people and me, we are one.
There you go. We are one. Many campfires, but one mob. Amy, that brings us to an end today.
Yep.
What have we got tomorrow?
I actually can't remember off the top of my head. I think I'm having a...
Tune in. Well, it is Monday. I mean, we're not expected
to. Oh, and Jonathan Hunya from Nadja talking about the death in custody up Darwin.
Okay. Yep. Nadja, the Northern Australian Aboriginal Justice Associate Justice Agency. Make sure you join us on your local First Nations station for Let's Talk. Have a great day.